Hello, I'm Susan Auerbach, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Stephen Batchelor. He's an internationally acclaimed Buddhist scholar, teacher, and author who has developed a secular approach to Buddhist practice. He has written a number of articles and books about this secular approach. Just a few of these books include Alone with Others, The Faith to Doubt, The Awakening of the West, Buddhism Without Beliefs, Confessions of a Buddhist Atheist, and his most recent book, the culmination of 40 years of scholarship and thought, After Buddhism, Rethinking the Dharma for a Secular Age. Welcome, Stephen Batchelor.
Thank you, Susan. It's lovely to be here.
First, I just wanted to tell you how important your work has been to me in my training as a rabbi, because I have a similar secular approach to my tradition, and I also have a practice of a meditation practice, and what you have written speaks to me very strongly, and it has just helped me in my personal life tremendously. So thank you so much.
That's okay. Good.
So let's talk about the book. I have a question about why it's important to legitimate your teaching with early sources. I know in rabbinics, if I quote a sage when I'm giving a talk, people are going to listen to me more than if I just say, well, this seems wise to me. And I do get really excited if a sage said something that makes sense to me, you know, now and then. But basically, could you share with us your reasons for pointing out these early sources?
Mm-hmm. Well, to answer your question in the kind of detail it deserves would probably take most of the rest of our time. In some ways, you have to see this as part of a quest that I've been on for the last 40 years, and that is to try to sort of burrow back to what the very kernel of the Dharma is about. And ever since I began with the Tibetan Buddhist training in the Gelugpa school, I was told to critically analyze everything that I was reading, not to take it just on trust, but to look at it in terms of whether it's made sense, whether it's reasonable, whether it was compatible with our current understanding of the world, and so on. And my Zen training likewise emphasized the priority of questioning, of great doubt. Mm-hmm. And this resonated, in any case, with my own sort of upbringing as a humanist, as an agnostic, possibly as an atheist, which again was a tradition in which you were very strongly encouraged to think things out for yourself. Mm-hmm. So at some level, therefore, my critical study of Buddhism has been a pursuit of my own critical mind, as it were. But it's, of course, it's far more than that. So in many ways, this project of mine has been going back all these years as an extension of my own critical inquiry. The other sense of it that has to qualify that, though, is that I feel that I belong to a tradition. And my whole adult life has been steeped in this tradition, which, for lack of a better word, we call Buddhism. I much prefer to call it simply the Dharma, but we're going to call it Buddhism. And people often ask me, in a sense a bit like you have, you know, if this stuff is true, what does it matter if the Buddha said so as well? What does that add? Mm-hmm. Now, in some respects, it doesn't add anything at all. And if you look at the way that mindfulness is now being appropriated in healthcare, for example, it really doesn't matter at all that the Buddha found this out 2,500 years ago. Mm-hmm. Point is, the thing works, therefore it can be used. But I feel that what I'm looking for in the Dharma is not just a set of effective self-help techniques that could be stripped out of the overall philosophical and ethical context, but I'm seeking to find a way of life, what the Greeks would call eudaimonia, a process of flourishing fully as a person. Mm-hmm. And I find it very difficult, if not impossible, to conceive of such a goal, standing outside of all traditions. Mm-hmm. I think that we are always in a tradition, and a lot of Buddhists would be quite happy that I didn't call myself a Buddhist. And I toyed with that idea. I said, okay, let's imagine I just drop all of that. Mm-hmm. I think it would be fundamentally dishonest, because it would not be acknowledging the sources of my own inquiry, interests, passions over the years. Mm-hmm. But also, it seems to imply that, you know, you can just somehow stand and float free of all tradition. In fact, if I were not a Buddhist, I'd probably then be labeled as some kind of secular humanist of one brand or another, and would likewise be utilizing authorities' texts. I'd be citing Montaigne, and I'd be citing Wittgenstein and Heidegger, and going back to... You cannot get out of this. And I think it's part of the conceit of Western individualism that the individual person can somehow exist independently without any kind of need to be embedded in a matrix of relationships that constitute both a community in the present and a tradition in time. So for me, this practice, this inquiry is a critical inquiry. It is founded on certain secular principles, if you wish, those of the European Enlightenment, mm-hmm. but at the same time, it's deeply sourced and rooted in Buddhist tradition. So to quote the Buddha, for me, somehow helps embed and locate me within the unfolding of this tradition. I don't see tradition as a fixed thing that we somehow have to just accord ourselves to blindly and just repeat what great figures of the past have said. I see tradition as something in which we root ourselves in order to be able to flourish more fully. And I remember once... shortly after the fall of the Berlin Wall, I was in Berlin, and there was a graffiti on the wall that said, a culture without history is like a tree without roots. Mm-hmm. In other words, to be rooted in tradition, I think, is inescapable, even if we try to deny it, because then we're just being part of the Western individualistic project. And therefore to become self-conscious of one's embeddedness in tradition and to see that as a source of nourishment, a source of inspiration, a source of insight, a source of a record of people far more intelligent and wise than myself having something to say about these things that more or less are coherent from one generation to the next. Mm-hmm. I find that both emotionally and spiritually very, very, very grounding and very affirming. It gives me confidence, it gives me courage in what I'm doing, that if I were in a hypothetical situation able to be a little isolate monad coming up with all these clever ideas all by myself, I wouldn't have that. But again, I think it exposes the fact of the illusory nature of the isolate monad, cut off from all sources. It doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes a lot of sense, what you just said, which leads me to your methodology for discovering. I mean, the book is very clear about how you find what you think was the original Dharma and that a lot has been added on to it. I mean, Bible study can, or Talmud study can do the same sort of thing of, you know, layers and layers and analyzing and who said what and why they said it and trying to separate it out. And I know people have been looking for the historical Jesus by, you know, looking at texts. Could you talk a little bit about your methodology for discovering what you think to be the true words or ideas of Gautama?
Okay. Well, to be quite honest, I have to admit here to being a shameless thief. I've taken most of my methodological approaches from biblical studies, particularly from projects like that of the Jesus Seminar, mm-hmm. Through establishing criteria for at least getting some sense of probability whether a particular text goes back to an earlier or to a later date. Mm-hmm. And having been brought up as a Westerner, I'm infused with the very idea of historical consciousness, that the traditions evolve and adapt and emerge according to the different circumstances and conditions under which they find themselves. And Buddhism, therefore, is to me something like it's more like an organism that somehow adapts and moves. And I think as Westerners, as moderns, as secularists, we cannot but be drawn into an historical questioning as to where did all this stuff come from. If we think of ourselves as Buddhists, then we are founding that identity on the life of a man called Gautama. It's all we know. Siddhartha is a later edition. Gautama, Mr. Gautama, Bull Gautama. And I deeply want to know who this man was. Under what sort of conditions did he live? What was his world like? And what did he say that must have struck his listeners as so striking that they made a concerted effort to remember it? Now, that's been my project. And I use both historical critical methods. I use, to some degree, philological methods. But to be quite honest, Buddhist studies in this area is nowhere near at the level that we'll find in the Christian or in the Judaic traditions. They've had armies of scholars and linguists and theologians addressing these questions probably now for nearly 200 years. The search for the historical Jesus begins with, say, David Strauss, like 1850s, 1860s. The Buddhists have not really even begun this. There are a handful of scholars, Richard Gombrich is probably one of the most well-known, and others, who are minimally funded. The Buddhist community has not risen to the task of saying, okay, we need to fund a bunch of people to really take this question seriously. It's a bunch of oddballs, people like myself, Johannes Bronckhorst is another one, who are trying our best to somehow make some sense out of the bewildering mass of data. So I think I have to be very honest here and acknowledge that most of my conclusions are pretty tentative, to be frank. It would be enormously arrogant to claim some of the things that I perhaps do claim with the sort of certitude that you would find in, say, Christian or Jewish circles regarding the, you know, the historicity of certain statements in the Bible. So that's my approach, and I think it's as much a kind of a personal passion as it is a strict scholarly endeavor, which I'm not, you know, that qualified to do, to be quite frank. But I cannot but do this kind of work because it's what, to me, draws me, in a sense, irresistibly to those questions that I'm seeking to unravel. But on the other hand, I think it's worth pointing out that I'm not interested in arriving at some sort of foundational set of teachings or doctrines or practices and a clear historical picture of this person and jump and somehow just kind of then saying, right, that's it, that's all we need to know. We don't need to do anything else now. We've cleared away all the dross. Here's the real thing. You end up as a fundamentalist. And I'm not interested in being a fundamentalist.
I think what you uncover is that there are important people who were not monks but lived ordinary lives, and they're not spoken about often. So you think that these words about them are authentic as opposed to some things that got tacked on later.
Okay. Well, I think what happened, and this is almost unavoidable, is that the Buddhist texts were memorized and then preserved by bodies of monastics. So it's hardly surprising that monastics get increasingly a good press, and often it's the teachings and practices that are most addressing themselves to monastic life that seem to be the ones that are privileged and remembered. Maybe a lot got lost along the way. But in terms of the criteria of authenticity that we find amongst biblical scholars, if you find material in these early canonical texts that would not have been in the interests of the monastic preserves to have added at a later date, that's the criterion for reliability.
That makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. So let's take, for example, the figure of Mahanama, Now, Martin Armer is not a person most Buddhists would have ever heard of, unless they confused him. He's one of the five ascetics of the first discourse, also called Mahanama. Again, a pretty obscure figure. But Mahanama that I explore in my book After Buddhism is a character we can actually reconstruct a fairly detailed biography of. Mm-hmm. There's numerous discourses in which Mahanama is in dialogue with the Buddha. Mm-hmm. If we pick out all the different episodes where Mahanama is mentioned, in the suttas, but also I also draw upon certain commentarial texts as well, we begin to get a very clear picture of who this man was. He was the Buddha's first cousin, and he effectively took on the job that Gautama would probably have had to have. In other words, as the governor or the ruler of Sakya, he took that role on. Mm-hmm. And he became a follower of Gautama, probably at a fairly early date. Mm-hmm. And they remained in dialogue and conversation and as part of the same community right up until the end of their respective lives. Mm-hmm. So by drawing this figure out, by looking at the dialogues that he had with the Buddha, that sheds an enormous amount of light, not only on the particular teachings that's given, many of which have to do with stream entry, which again nowadays is thought of as some dizzily high mystical attainment. Mm-hmm. Whereas in fact here it's basically conversion, I think is what I call it. Mm-hmm. Also you get a very vivid glimpse into his family life, into the life of the Sakya community, in the life of a person who had a position of authority, power at that time, a person who was caught up in the political conflicts with the greater power of Kosala next door. Suddenly, the Buddha's world of 4th century, 5th century BC begins to open up. Now, I find it very difficult to consider that all of this rather tawdry and quirky material was invented at a later point. For what reason?
Right.
When Buddhists started inventing stories of kings and so on, they were always mythologized. Mm-hmm. They were always these more than perfect people living in these impossibly beautiful palaces and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. That's Mahanama doesn't come across that way at all. Mm-hmm. He comes across as a recognizably human figure who is quite open about his internal conflicts within himself. He's very concerned about the political struggles he's involved in. All of this comes out. Mm-hmm. And what's amazing is when you pick out these different passages that are sort of scattershot throughout thousands of pages of text, they all hang together. Mm-hmm. And not only do they hang together in the Pali, they hang together in another body of text, which is preserved in Tibetan. You get the story. So to me, this is a very strong indication that that what we're dealing with is actually something that happened in historical time with human beings, very much like our own, like ourselves. Mm-hmm. And it means that the teachings that are given are thereby not being addressed to a kind of spiritual elite of highly realized monks, but they're being delivered to people caught up in the cut and thrust of living in the world with all of the conflicts and tragedies and turmoils and unpredictabilities that we all face.
That's a good way to lead into talking about the Dharma and about what stream entry means, what you think it meant to Gautama and Nirvana. I mean, I love reading your book about these ideas about Nirvana, for example, which is very different than this idea of 30 years of practice and maybe you'll achieve Nirvana. It's so practical and helpful. Just reading it makes me feel like it's possible for us to live in community and not be reactive with each other and create a better world. So I'd love if you would talk a little bit about what Nirvana is, for example.
Okay. Well, you see, this is, again, a good example of why it's useful to be able to cite early texts. If Stephen Batchelor were to say, I think this is what Nirvana is, I don't think anybody's going to pay a huge amount of attention. That's just my opinion. But if I can make a claim about Nirvana or about stream entry that I can ground in early canonical material, then it carries obviously a great deal more weight. And again, another figure who's been very influential in my thinking about all of this, I'll get back to your point in a minute, is Ludwig Feuerbach, who wrote The Essence of Christianity in 1844, I think it was, who basically described religions, organized religions, as systems of alienation, that they cut off the ordinary person from their essential nature, which he talks of as love, wisdom, and power, and you project that onto the
priests,
enlightened elite, the priests, who almost always in cahoots with the aristocracy, and thereby legitimate a power system, whereby the ordinary person, as a Christian or a Jew or a Buddhist, is somehow disempowered, and they project all of their values onto others who then carry that power, that love, and that wisdom. So what I find with my, with notions like stream entry, for example, or nirvana, is that they've suffered from this process of alienation. They've been ratcheted up to increasingly remote degrees of almost unattainability, or at the best, only after you've been a monk for X number of lifetimes and you've done X number of years in retreat and so on. And they bring them back to Earth. So stream entry is in the Sotapatti Samyutta, the connected discourses on stream entry, is repeatedly declared to be attaining unwavering confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and being committed to the cultivation of the virtues of the noble ones. In other words, it's about a radical change in the direction of your life in terms of its the core values that you consciously accept you wish to live your life by, namely being more awake, emulating the awakened one, the Buddha, being committed to a practice of the Dharma, and being embedded in a network of friendships and relationships that nurture that practice. And it's then described as the cultivation of virtues. It's an ethical process, essentially. And it doesn't mean that you've achieved any kind of spiritual perfection. Far from it. Someone like Mahanama, who is regarded unequivocally as a stream entrant in the early text, is someone who suffers all of the kind of turmoil and stresses and pains and upsurges of sensual desire that the rest of us do. So that makes stream entry very much into basically an expression of commitment. But we also have in another very early source, the concept of stream entry as we find it in Theravada Buddhism today, which is that of having lost the fetter of Sakaya Ditti, which means something like egoism, lost the fetter of doubt, and lost the fetter of what's usually translated as attachment to rites and rituals, which I don't think is what it means at all. I explain that in the book. But basically, that's another way of looking at it, at stream entry. That's a more psychological way of looking at it. But it also has a very old pedigree. So I think we have to somehow find a way to bring these two accounts into alignment. And I don't think that's too difficult. I think the loss of doubt is quite evidently what would be achieved by attaining unwavering confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Doubt, at some level at least, has been put to one side. I think attachment to rites and rituals means something much closer to adopting a situational ethic that is no longer bound to moral rules. The word rites and rituals is actually sila bhata, which means sila means morality, bhata means rules, ordered rules. So I take sila bhata paramasa, the loss of attachment to rites and rituals, to mean no longer being attached to moral rules. In other words, trying to live one's life according to a moral textbook like the Talmud or the Vinaya or something, and looking up the answer to your moral dilemmas as though every single one of them has been accounted for.
More part of situational ethics.
It's a situational ethic. And when the Buddha describes the stream entrant as one who has become independent of others in the teaching, again, a term that's not much advertised elsewhere, but that's a common phrase, it means that a person who has entered the stream of this path has achieved a degree of moral autonomy in their practice. And the third one is about the loss of self, of egotism. I would take this to mean something like a loss of vanity. It's a sort of a sense of oneself as no longer being the center of the universe, mm-hmm. around which everything else rotates, but at least a degree of insight, a glimpse into the fact that you are not your body or your mind or your feelings or your perceptions, that you are essentially a congeries of mental, physical, emotional forces that are held together as a continuum of a person, but there's nothing solid or fixed or somehow permanent that you can attach onto as who you really are. Now, so in other words, this stream entry operates within that perspective, that philosophical and ethical understanding, but it is framed by a degree of commitment, a mm-hmm. degree of committing oneself to these core values. And that is something that, again, there's a famous story in the Sotapatti Samyutta of Sarakani, the Sakyan, who was a local drunk. And when he died, the Buddha said he was a stream entrant. And even then, the other Sakyans wouldn't believe him. They said, how's that possible? He was a drunk. And the Buddha very movingly says, if one were to say of anyone that he was a stream entrant, gone to refuge for the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and so on, it is of Sarakani, the Sakyan, that one would say this. And that is a very strong statement. Again, one that's very difficult to imagine that a later monastic community would have invented. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they do that, mm-hmm. it would be undermining their own authority. It wouldn't make any sense at all. Mm-hmm. And yet we have to be enormously grateful that because monastic communities tended to be very literally minded as well, they preserved all this mm-hmm. stuff. They didn't sort of edit it out. I suspect a lot got chopped out. Mm-hmm. But they were very faithful, I think.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot in the Bible like that as well. That just,
well, there you go.
You know, all of this so-called idolatry that's in there, but they can't take it out because you have to keep it all intact. So
well, exactly. It's the same problem. It's not a problem. I think it's a great gift, really, mm-hmm. is that the Pali Canon was closed probably around the time of Christ. And from mm-hmm. that point on, it just got repeated. Mm-hmm. And they didn't necessarily understand what it was saying, mm-hmm. but they repeated it, wrote it down, repeated it, wrote it down. So we do have we are the beneficiaries of generations of people who have, you know, preserved this stuff for us. Mm-hmm. So I'm enormously grateful.
Yes, and I hope our listeners will pick up your book and look in more detail about all of these ideas that you're talking about very briefly here, because there's so much more about the methodology and stream entry and the idea of nirvana. Maybe we could talk now about the four tasks as opposed to the four noble truths. I enjoyed reading about that. It makes a lot of sense in the context of what you're talking about, that it's more about action than hard absolutes or metaphysical, you know. It developed into more of an institutional form over time. And could you talk a little bit about the four tasks?
Four tasks. we didn't talk about nirvana, but I'll try to weave this in there as well. Mm-hmm. I was alerted to this idea of the four truths as four tasks by an English bhikkhu called Jnana Veerathera, who lived in Sri Lanka during the 50s. And in his collected letters, he's the first person who somehow flags this point, or at least flags it in a way that really struck me very deeply. And so I went back to the Buddha's first sermon, what's called the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the turning of the wheel of Dhamma. And as Jnana Veera pointed out, the sutta concludes with the definition of the Buddha's awakening in the Buddha's own words. It was not until my knowledge and vision were entirely clear about the 12 aspects of these four truths that I could consider myself to have attained a Pyrrhus awakening. Now that, to me, is a very foundational statement. Now, the 12 aspects of the four truths, we don't have time to go into detail here, but basically they boil down to his saying that I could only consider myself awake when I had recognized, performed, and accomplished four tasks. In other words, each truth is accompanied by a particular task, a particular action. A suffering, the first truth, is accompanied by the action or the task to fully know it or to comprehend it.
Mm-hmm.
Second truth, which has to do with craving, or what I now prefer to call reactivity, is accompanied by the task of letting go of it. The stopping of suffering, which is the third truth, and which is defined as the stopping of reactivity or craving, is to be accompanied by the task of beholding or realizing that stopping.
Mm-hmm.
And the fourth truth, which is the Eightfold Path, is accompanied by the task of cultivating or developing or bringing into being the Eightfold Path, which is a complete human way of life. Now, once you shift the emphasis away from truths, which immediately gets you into thinking about, is this true or is this false?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many conversations you have had, but I've lost count of the number of mm-hmm. times I had to try to justify
mm-hmm.
To a non-Buddhist that life is suffering.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean life is suffering? There's all this joy. And so you have to say, well, you know. But it sets a frame of thinking and seeing and talking as soon as you introduce the word truth. If you introduce the word task and you start from that, then immediately the question becomes, how do you do that?
Mm-hmm.
Not, is that true, is that false?
Mm-hmm.
And my sense is, and I argue this through the book, is that Buddhism started out as a pragmatic ethics. In other words, as a task-based way of life. And the aim of the process of practicing the Dharma was actually to do certain things in such a way that they made a qualitative difference to how you lived and how you were part of your world, part of your society. It was all about action. At some point, it seems as though the emphasis shifted away from that to becoming convinced of the Four Noble Truths. In other words, four propositions that claim to describe the nature of reality. That existence is somehow dukkha, it's suffering, that the origin of suffering is craving, and so on. In other words, you slip into what I think cannot but be called metaphysics.
Mm-hmm.
And those truth claims, if accepted, then make you into a believer. Your practice is then founded on those beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
But the beliefs are kind of presented as the necessary underpinning for everything else you do. If you didn't hold those views, if you didn't have right view in those areas, you know, your practice wouldn't have any foundation. If you go the task-based route, that basically all that becomes irrelevant. What matters is, can you perform these tasks or not? Can you embrace suffering? Can you let go of reactivity? Can you see the stopping of reactivity? And can you live and act and think and speak in a way that's not conditioned by reactivity?
Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting also how you translate summa into complete instead of right.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, it is a summa is more literally, that's what the word means. Right to me has a rather uncomfortable moralistic to it. So I'm not too comfortable with it. It's not an incorrect translation. I mean, it is legitimate at some level. But you see, what it points to is how the translators tend to be completely locked into the mindset of truth, of
mm-hmm.
right, of wrong,
mm-hmm.
in morality,
mm-hmm.
rather than what's appropriate or inappropriate in a situation.
Mm-hmm.
And then truth then becomes morphed into relative truth, absolute truth, and all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all of those shifts, in a way, were instrumental in turning Buddhism into another Indian religion,
mm-hmm.
based on beliefs, based on an understanding of what the ultimate nature of reality is or was, and based upon a kind of a non-negotiable set of moral truths. And to that degree, I feel that they lost touch with what you find when you go back to some of these earliest texts,
mm-hmm.
That I think you can find ample justification for thinking in this way by resurrecting some you know, some very classical Buddhist ideas. Mm-hmm. Like Nirvana, for example, the Buddha says that Nirvana is clearly visible and immediate. Dharma is clearly visible and immediate. It's not something you have to wait X number of years to ever get a handle on. It's right here and now. It's very Zen mm-hmm. in that respect, extremely Zen. And in this way, in this book particularly, I've also recovered some of my roots in the Zen tradition too. I think the quality of inquiry and questioning, as you do in koan practice, is to me very much at the heart of what this practice is about. It's about keeping an open and questioning mind. Mm-hmm. It's very similar to early Greek skepticism. Mm-hmm. It has this sort of Pyrrhonian refusal to make any kind of general declarations about what is the case with the world or oneself, to mm-hmm. keep that open mind. So, yeah, I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. You're talking about Pyro or Puro. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, but it brings to mind what Robert Ellis is trying to do in founding the Middle Way Society. Mm-hmm. And what do you think about that approach of having a Middle Way Society independent of Buddhist tradition, even though it's very Buddhist?
Well, I've discussed this with Robert. I'm not persuaded that the language that he uses does allow him to fly free of Buddhism. And I don't know how he would respond to that. I think the Middle Way is a very foundational Buddhist idea. Mm-hmm. I completely sympathize with his frustration at working within a Buddhist context. I have the same problems. Mm-hmm. I get a lot of Buddhists who really are not very, very against what I'm doing. They think it's heretical. They think it's trivializing the Dharma, whatever it might be. But I'm prepared to put up with that because I do feel in my heart that I am coming from this tradition. I'm speaking out of my understanding of this tradition. I practice both spiritually and also ethically within the framework of this tradition. Mm-hmm. I don't like the word Buddhism particularly, but I think it would be, in my own case at least, it would be bad faith to mm-hmm. somehow discard all references to the Pali Canon or the mm-hmm. Buddha or whatever. I don't feel any need to do that, mm-hmm. although I could see how at some level it would make my life a lot easier. Mm-hmm. But in that sense, I don't really go along with Robert's attempt to fly free of Buddhism, although I wish him all the very best. And in fact, that may turn out in the long term to be the way to go. I mean, at a certain point, I think we're going to have to, I would very much like to drop the words Buddhism, maybe adopt the word Dharma. But as you were saying, I mean, if this wisdom, if this philosophical tradition, ethical tradition has any, you know, integrity to it, then it shouldn't require its being formally tied to a particular religious institution, Buddhism. It should be able to somehow have its own, to have its own life, mm-hmm. and so I'm very glad that Robert is doing what he's doing. I think he's taking this into directions that possibly it would have been more difficult for him had he stuck to the Buddhist identity. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, when I read his material and I listen to podcasts and so on, you know, there's an inescapable awareness that there is this tension. Mm-hmm. With this Buddhist past that is acknowledged and somehow not acknowledged at the same time.
This actually brings me to, so you're creating a post-metaphysical Dharma, or you're communicating and teaching a post-metaphysical Dharma, secular Dharma, that addresses our concerns now and the future. And one way you're doing that, I was reading online that you have a college called Bodhi College. You're going mm-hmm. to be having courses. Would you like to talk about that?
Yeah, the Bodhi College was an initiative that I started having discussions about 2 years ago now. And four of us, Christina Feldman, who's a Vipassana teacher, John Peacock, who's a Buddhist academic and meditation teacher, Kinchen Ovebo, who's a former Theravada Buddhist monk, we all kind of came up with the same idea around the same time, namely to put together a study and practice program that would be focused pretty much entirely on what we call early Buddhism. Early Buddhism being the name we give to, let's say, the discourses of the Pali Canon, their translations in Chinese and Tibetan and elsewhere. But before these teachings became the basis for any particular Buddhist school or Buddhist orthodoxy. So it's, again, is a similar project in some ways to my book, getting back to sources. But we, the four of us, have quite different views as to, you know, how we could best value and study and practice these things. But we're united in the sense that there's something about these early teachings that seem to speak very directly to the condition we're in now. A lot of traditional Buddhism speaks through the filter of Indian cosmology, of Japanese samurai ethos, of Tibetan shamanism, or whatever it is. And in doing so, I think sometimes what the Dharma that lies at the root of those traditions somehow gets obscured, or it gets sort of turned in ways that are no doubt terribly valuable for Tibetans and Chinese and so on, but may not actually speak as directly as they could to the conditions of modernity. Mm-hmm. And what I find, so when you say I'm teaching or proposing a non-metaphysical Dharma, I would actually like to reframe that as recovering the non-metaphysical Dharma. The Buddha's, I mean, some of the classic sources, like the unanswered questions, for example, the 10 unanswered questions, I think make it very clear that the Buddha was not interested in erecting some metaphysical framework of belief. Mm-hmm. So the Bodhi College is offering a number of two-year courses, as well as a training program for people who are already teaching mindfulness. Again, I think this whole mindfulness movement is giving rise to a whole new wave of people coming to the Dharma, not because they're interested in Buddhism, but because they've had an experience in their meditation practice through mindfulness that's really made an important difference. They're looking for a philosophy, an ethic, a way of life that they can somehow take that transformative experience further for them. So the Bodhi College is kind of addressing this new situation. It's, on the one hand, going back to sources. On the other hand, it's addressing very much contemporary needs and trying to free itself from being identified with any particular Buddhist school or orthodoxy. And you can get more information if you go to our website, which is www.bodhicollege.org, I think.
Yes, it's B-O-D-H-I-dash.
Hyphen college, that's right.
Hyphencollege.org.
Yeah.
So for people interested, but you need to be in England, Germany, Switzerland, and Italy.
Yes, it's a European venture. We're very committed to that. There's a lot going on in the US, and although we do have interest from America, we're going to focus our attention, at least in the first years, in developing a project in both England and continental Europe.
Great. Is there anything else that you would like to share with our audience, our middle way audience that we have in the
Well, nothing really. I would, of course, be very honored if you would take the time to read my book, and if you find it of help, then I would be very glad about that. Again, I think you've got a wonderful community, a society developing, and to commit yourselves to it, to try to take forward the the inspirational ideas that Robert Ellis and others have come up with. And I'm very much in sympathy and support with everything you're doing.
I think there's one thing very much in common with what you're doing, and not just the idea of the middle way, that living this life and trying to find a practice that makes sense is an art more than a science. And that integration, using the imagination, and I think you talk about that as well.
No, that's right. I'm somewhat concerned about how Buddhism is often presented as a science of the mind. Mm-hmm. I suspect there is something to be said for that, and I think it is quite extraordinary the extent to which, say, some of these meditation practices can bare clinical testing and so forth. But I think there's a great danger that we succumb to our technological mindset and we think of Buddhism just as a rather sophisticated set of techniques for solving the problems of human existence. That language to me is quite anathema. Mm-hmm. And I feel personally, and I guess this is also reflective of my own temperament, I've always felt that the practice of the Dharma is more like an art. Mm-hmm. And I don't just say this because I just like the idea, but because I do practice as an artist. My writing I see as a practice of literature. I take photographs, which I've been taking for many, many years. I do collage work. And all of these activities, these artistic activities, are for me very resonant with what I call my practice of the Dharma. Mm-hmm. And my practice of the Dharma, my body and my mind, as it were, are the raw materials of my art, mm-hmm. if you want to extend that metaphor. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, does include imagination. It includes creativity. It includes learning to think outside the box. It includes working towards cultivating a vision and not just somehow believing that Buddhism has established itself in all these traditions over these years. It's complete and perfect as is. It's just our job to put these practices into action and then we'll benefit them and we'll generate the results. Bingo. I find that's a very deadening way to consider the Dharma. But most traditions, Buddhist traditions, don't really think there's any room for much improvement. Maybe you could tinker with this or tinker with that. But effectively, every Buddhist tradition believes that it's somehow got the final definitive teaching and practice that is all that you really need. And that may be helpful to many people, but frankly, I find myself rebelling against that kind of view of things, that mm-hmm. there is nothing more to know. There's mm-hmm. nothing more to be done. I think when we look at Buddhism historically, we can see that it's endlessly mutating and changing. Mm-hmm. According to new circumstances. And that alone, to me, it raises a lot of these ideas of the Dharma as a science, as a technology, as a technique, highly questionable. Because they may be techniques, technologies that work well in particular settings, but do they speak to the condition we're in now? It's to some degree, yes, but I think in many degrees, no. So we need the imagination. We need to think differently about what we're doing.
Yes. That makes a lot of sense, and I think that's true in all of the religions.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
If we don't do that, we end up with crazy fundamentalism. I mean, that's the extreme that ends up. But all religious practices have evolved over time and changed, and sometimes mm-hmm. for the better and sometimes
for
the worse. So, but if you look at the core, at the beginning, there's a lot more there in Islam, for example. I mean, what Muhammad did was end all of this tribal fighting. I mean, if you look at the beginning, and every religion has a core beginning that is very inspiring. So what you're doing with Buddhism, I think we could all do with each of our religions and try to use our imaginations to develop something that makes sense now and that can change in the future, which you talk about in your book as well. So I suggest to everyone that you go to whatever bookstore you go to or order online After Buddhism, Rethinking the Dharma for a Secular Age, and learn more about the origin of this wonderful way of life, really. It's not a tradition, it's a way of life. And it has a lot to offer the whole world. So thank you so much for sharing.
Well, thank you, Susan. That's very generous of you to say those things.
It's true.
Wish you all the best.
Thank you.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.